Our text is going to be 1 Samuel chapter 30. We're kind of in between our Advent series and a new series that we'll be launching into next Sunday. But I want to look at David today, and I want to particularly look at David's perspective, a God-oriented perspective, or as I've kind of phrased it, David wore God-colored glasses, right? We talk about people who wear rose-colored glasses, who always see things, you know, even if it's crummy circumstances, they're looking through a rose-colored lens. And but we're talking about viewing things from God's perspective. And perspective makes a big difference. Vantage point makes a big difference. We could take one scene and have a couple people look at it from different vantage points, and they might come away with a very different impression. I have never been to, to the Grand Canyon, so I'm going to have to experience it through pictures, at least for now. But here's an image of the canyon from the bottom of the canyon. And it's a beautiful image, isn't it? I mean, that sense of the walls of the canyon going up on either side of you, I've got to think that it's kind of quiet, sort of sheltered from the wind and other noises down in the midst of that canyon. And you have, of course, the river kind of running down through there as well. The way the light hits off, the sunlight's hitting off the sides of the canyon. It's a beautiful image. But, of course, we know that it's limited in a certain sense, that you're not able to fully appreciate all the scope and the majesty of the Grand Canyon from that perspective. But if you get a perspective from up high, or maybe even an aerial view, you're able to see just how immense it is. And you get a sense of sort of the origin of that river and its end point and where it's going. And you get a different sort of perspective. And I'm suggesting that something similar is the case as we think about our own lives, right? We of course, view things from a human perspective, and that perspective is often beautiful, full of wonder, sometimes full of heartache, right? We see things as mortals, as people who are constrained to time and space. We see what's right in front of us, but we, of course, can't see around the bend. I can't see where this river is ultimately going. It's a limited view. It's a good view, but it's a limited view. We're only able to fully appreciate and understand our lives when we have a view from above. Just always remember that God, in His sovereignty, has a far bigger plan than we can perceive from our perspective. So sometimes we can get downright discouraged and feel defeated or anxious because of what we are encountering, and the need to have to continue to think and contemplate our lives from God's perspective. So I think David does a really good job of that here in this text. And as I just think about where we're at culturally and even in terms of the church, a particular stage in our point in history, with whether it be COVID or whether it be racial issues or political issues, I just praying that God would continue to give us His mind and His eyes to be able to see these circumstances from His perspective. So that's going to be our task this morning out of 1 Samuel 30. There's at least three different sort of distinct ways, I think, in which David brings this God perspective, or in which he wears these God-colored glasses. And I'm going to put each of them in the form of an exhortation or a challenge for us here today. First, you should look to God in crisis. You should look to God in crisis. Let's look at these opening verses, 1 Samuel 30. Now when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. So you should look to God in crisis. David was on the run from King Saul, and David was running out of places to hide. So we found different times here throughout 1 Samuel where David is on one side of the mountain and Saul is on the other side, and they're chasing each other around, and Saul's closing in. I mean, several close calls, but God, of course, preserved David. But David, over time here, people had begun to come out to David, people who had fallen out of favor with King Saul, people who were experiencing various elements of brokenness in their lives. They developed a heart for David. They came out to him. Soon there was 600. These were just fighting men. So it was a big group. You couldn't just hide behind a rock anymore with 600 people and their families. So at a certain point, David actually goes to Moab. He leaves Israel and goes over to Moab. He had some family history there in Moab on Israel's southeastern border. And I stayed there for a time, but again, soon there was other pressures that were coming to bear there. And finally, David does the unthinkable. He leads his group of followers into the Philistine country. These were Israel's sworn enemies. But seemingly, David concluded, at least here, Saul won't bother me. Saul wouldn't dare attack the Philistines in order to get to me. So at least I'll be safe. So this is where we find David. He's actually living among the Philistines. And the Philistines were preparing for a major attack on Israel. So the Philistines lived along the coast, along the Mediterranean Sea, on the left side of this image. And the red arrows just kind of represents their gathering armies from the five major Philistine cities. And they are making their way north. And you see Israel's armies as well, the green arrow, making their way north. The battle was going to take place there at Mount Gilboa. So David's along for the ride with his men. Due to a series of different circumstances, David is sent home. So he doesn't engage in this conflict. He is sent home. He makes that journey back down from the northern part of Israel up by the Sea of Galilee, back down all the way to the bottom of this map to Ziklag, which was the city where he had been living. Now, of course, in the midst of all of this, something else happens. The Philistines are going to the north, Israel's going to the north, and the opportunistic Amalekites attack from the south. And, of course, a lot of these villages are sitting ducks, right? Because all the men and the soldiers, all those who were able to fight, were up fighting. So these cities were vulnerable, and they attacked David's city of Ziklag. So when David and his men return back home, they find everything destroyed. The city's burned down, all their possessions are gone, and of course, worst of all, their wives, their children have been taken captive. Of course, the people are devastated, beside themselves. The text says bitter in soul. They wept until they had no more strength to weep. They were completely spent. And then they got angry. The people got to thinking, "What? Somebody's to blame for this." And who are they to blame but David himself? David had led them into this alliance with the Philistines. David had gotten them into this mess. And they actually turned on David and talked of stoning him. David, of course, was hurting himself, right? His own wives had been taken captive. But in addition to that, now David had the heartache of being betrayed by his most loyal friends. So he had already been expelled from his country on the run. He writes about this in the Psalms. He couldn't worship anymore at the temple. I mean, and now even his friends turn against him. I mean, this is one of the lowest points in the life of David. C.H. Spurgeon, a British preacher, battled depression his whole life. what he called causeless depression. In our culture, we would say clinical depression, depression for which there is no explanation. And Spurgeon actually dedicated a chapter. He wrote a book to his students. He gave lectures to his students, training them for ministry. And he dedicated one whole lesson to depression, called it the minister's fainting fits. And he talked about the different times when a follower of Christ, a pastor in particular, is overcome with depression. And he talked about, in some cases, it's little things. It's a bunch of little things that just pile up to cause you to be discouraged. In some cases, it's one great blow. I just couldn't help but think about Spurgeon as I read here about David. I mean, just thing after thing. First, it's Saul. I mean, he was in Saul's court, remember, playing his harp for Saul, and then Saul turned on him, tried to kill him on several different occasions. And David had a really good friendship with Saul's son, Jonathan. I mean, they were close. But when David had to go on the run, he lost that friendship. He had to leave Jonathan. Again, he's expelled from the country. He's cut off from the worship of God in the temple courts. I mean, just thing after thing. And now, even his friends turn against him. Now, David could have easily despaired. He could have rejected or walked away from his faith. He could have grown bitter at God. But it's David's unique perspective here that I want us to notice. David clearly saw his life circumstances through God-colored glasses. It says here that he strengthened himself in the Lord his God. The particular word here has to do with reinforcing a structure, reinforcing the walls of a city, or reinforcing a tent that had some aspect that was broken, and you'd have to come in and prop it up again with a new stick or something, right? So I was talking to Dave Snyder a few weeks back. He had a big project at his house, a retaining wall that was beginning to give way. The boards were rotted out after 20 or 30 years, and he broke his back all summer having to move that dirt back and reinforce that retaining wall. And this is the idea here, that David strengthened himself or reinforced himself in the Lord. Now, what does that mean? How would David have done that? There's actually a related passage a little bit earlier in 1 Samuel where the same terminology is used. So it's another low point in David's life. And it says that Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, "You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this." So Jonathan comes and reinforces David here. And how does he do it? He reiterates to David God's promises. He says, "David, the prophet Samuel said that you were going to be the king. And you are. And you know what? Even my father Saul knows it. That's why he's so jealous. That's why he's so insecure. That's why he's trying to get rid of you. Because he knows that God has promised you the kingdom." So Jonathan reinforces David's faith by reminding him of God's promises. And I think that's what's happening now in this case in 1 Samuel 30. Jonathan's not around. David's alone. But now David is reinforcing his own faith. I think David's talking to himself. I think David's reminding himself of God's promises. You ever get a song in your head and you can't get it out? I've got a couple of my kids that have been singing You'll Be Back from Hamilton. You know the little scene there. You know, it's the King of England who is talking to his loyal subjects here on American shores. And he's saying, "You'll be back. You'll be back. You'll be back. Soon you'll see. You'll remember you belong to me." It's a catchy little tune, and I can't get this thing out of my head now. And it really doesn't matter. But sometimes you get something in your head that is not helpful. Sometimes you get something in your head that is not true. And you need to get that record out of there. You need a new playlist going on in your head. So D. Martin Lloyd Jones gave that great advice. He said, "We spend too much time listening to ourselves and not enough time talking to ourselves." It's true. We need to be talking to ourselves, reminding ourselves of what is true. Puritans talked about preaching to ourselves like the fiercest preacher, right? Telling ourselves, and the psalmist does this. Psalm 42, "Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your trust in God. Put your hope in God." The psalmist is talking to himself. This is what David is doing here. He's strengthening himself in the Lord. There's nothing, from what we can tell in the text, there's nothing supernatural that's happening there. It's not that God showed up and strengthened David. David strengthened himself in the Lord. He reinforced himself in the promises of God. So we can be discouraged about a lot of things. And I can be a glass half empty kind of guy. And there's COVID and never ending COVID restrictions and political divisions, chronic pain, cancer, Parkinson's disease, broken marriages, wayward children. My mind just went this week to so many in our own congregation. Ann Henriksen, boy, she's been struggling. She's been losing weight for 6 or 8 months. They did a gallbladder surgery. They thought maybe that was going to be part of the solution. It wasn't. They went in to do another procedure. I mean, it's been a long time. It's discouraging. Jackie Smith. Jackie had cancer surgery, removed abdominal tumor, and that tumor was around one of her kidneys, and that kidney's not been functioning since the surgery. And they went in and put a stent in, and it didn't work. I mean, we're talking over a year this has been going on, and she's struggling and in chronic pain. Talked to Tim Simonis and Dave Stevens. They went into a little business venture. They bought the Flint Wilderness Resort up in Ontario, Canada, about 12 hours due north, a place that they had often gone to fish and hunt, and they took on a new project, a new venture, invested a lot of money, and then COVID happened. And not a single American citizen could cross the border. None of their clients could go to the Flint Wilderness Resort this past summer, and this summer's in question. Oh. I mean, this is devastating stuff, you know? How do you process that? How are you doing in terms of responding in the midst of difficult circumstances? Where do you seek comfort and hope? And let's just be honest, we don't always seek comfort and hope in the places we should. Sometimes we self-medicate, whether it's alcohol or drugs or pornography or eating or shopping. We have ways of trying to distract ourselves from our troubles. Or maybe we depend on a person to comfort us, and when that person lets us down, now we're... At the end of the day, as David found, it's only the Lord that is able to remedy the problems that you face. The only one that will be true when everyone else betrays you. So you should look to God in crisis. David brings this great perspective in the midst of this bleak scene. He strengthens himself in the Lord. You should also look to God in confusion when you're facing decisions, when things are not clear. Notice how David models this. 1 Samuel 30, verse 7. "And David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, 'Bring me the ephod.' So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them?' He answered him, 'Pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue.' So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook of Bezor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men, 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Bezor. They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate. They gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and 2 clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. And David said to him, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you from?' He said, 'I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negeb of the Carathites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negeb of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, "Will you take me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band." Should look to God in confusion. David picks himself up and contemplates a course of action. And what I want you to notice here in this section is that David instinctively sends for Abiathar the priest and asks him to bring the ephod. The ephod was part of the priestly garment. And there's a lot of questions about how the ephod was used, but it represented the priest's authority and his position. And that's what a priest did, right, was to mediate between God and the people. And so David sends for the priest, and he inquires of God, what should we do? And will we have success if we go after these raiders? I'll be honest, if my wife and my children were abducted, I wouldn't engage in a lengthy prayer meeting. I'd be like Liam Neeson, you know, heading out across the, placing threatening phone calls, "I'm coming after you," you know. I just find something noble in David, even in the midst of these circumstances, that he just stops, as he so often did. This is characteristic of David, and he seeks the Lord's direction. And in the background here, remember that they had been up in Aphek, right, with the Philistine armies, where that battle was going to take place, and they had made the return trip 60 miles, nearly 60 miles, in 2 days. It's like walking from here to Muskegon with all your military gear, right? So his guys were tired. And I think that's part of the question. Do we stop and rest, get a night's sleep, or do we head off immediately? David's wondering if his men are even going to follow him at this point. You know, are our wives and children even still alive? Is there some reasonable chance that we could recover what we have lost? So all these things are going through his mind. There's this swirling mix of confusion and fear and doubt. And David takes it to the Lord. He inquires of the Lord. Bring the ephod. What a great phrase. Bring the ephod. Abiathar encouraged David to proceed and assured him of success. So David gathered all 600 of his men and they set off. Remember, they had already traveled nearly 60 miles, and now they travel another 16 miles to the brook of Bezor. And at that point, 200 of David's men are exhausted. They cannot go another step. So 200 of the men stop right there, and David, with the remaining 400, continue to press on. And just when the trail was running cold, they stumble upon an Amalekite slave who had been left for dead by his master. He had no love for the Amalekites, so he promises to lead David to them. David again seeks God's direction, and God directed his steps. David's actions are contrasted with those of King Saul. We see a lot of contrasts through here, throughout all of 1 Samuel, really, between King Saul and King David. But at the very time here, when David is asking for the ephod and calling for Abiathar the priest, Saul is consulting who? The witch of Endor. He's engaged just a couple chapters previous, but really in the same context here, we see this great contrast. I was reminded of it too with Solomon's son. So you have King Saul, and then you have King David, and then you have King Solomon. And then Solomon's son Rehoboam is the next king. And he was kind of a disaster. But Rehoboam was approached by some of the citizens. When he first became king, and some of the citizens said, "Hey, some of the things you're asking of us are extreme, and can you lessen some of the requirements that you've placed upon us?" And so Rehoboam goes to some of the wise counselors in Israel, and he says, "What do you think? Should I respond? Should I back down on some of my demands for the people?" And these wise counselors say, "Yes, you should. Be kind to them, and they will be loyal to you as long as you reign over Israel." But then Rehoboam went and talked to some of his friends, some of his cronies. So, "What do you think? Should I listen to these people?" And they said, no, don't listen to them. Be even harder on them than your father Solomon was. Really buckle down on them. And Solomon listened to that foolish counsel, and the kingdom was divided. He listened to that foolish counsel to his own ruin. Where do you go for counsel, for insight, when you face important decisions? Do you consult the polls, the surveys, the talking heads, the news stations? Hopefully it's not Oprah or Ellen or whoever happens to be the person of the flavor of the week, right? Some people just go with their instincts, like my gut tells me I ought to do this. Or do you seek godly counsel and consult the scriptures? We do not have priests wearing ephods, but we do have the scriptures, which are profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. Everything that the person of God needs to be able to make wise decisions. Now, the Bible doesn't talk about the internet. It doesn't talk about bioethics and cloning. But the Bible gives us everything we need to know to be able to navigate everything we would encounter in this life. And prayer is that we, like David, would go to God in the midst of our confusion and seek and inquire of the Lord. So you should look to God in crisis. You should look to God in confusion. You should also look to God in success. Verse 16. And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought all. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. And they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart." But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." It was for those in Bethel, in Ramot of the Negeb, in Jatir, in Aror, in Shipmot, in Eshtemoah, in Rakal, in the cities of the Jeremelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, in Borashan, in Attak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. You should look to God in success. David catches up with the Amalekites, finds them reveling in their recent victories. David and his men attack and bring about a resounding victory. They put the Amalekites to the sword. Don't miss the fact that King Saul had the kingdom removed because he didn't deal with the Amalekites, at least in part. The Amalekites were the sworn enemy of God's people. Matter of fact, when Israel came out of Egypt, they were slaves, right? They didn't have weapons. They were vulnerable people. God brought them out with a mighty hand. The Amalekites attacked them in their weakness. The Amalekites were under God's curse, and God had asked King Saul to bring his judgment against the Amalekites. And Saul hesitated. Saul had some better ideas with how to handle that whole situation. Here David is doing what Saul should have done. And I think it's telling that David refers to the Amalekites here as the enemies of the Lord. It wasn't just David's enemies. David could have been like, I'm gonna kill you. You took my wives, you took my children. I hate you. But that wasn't David's posture. David identified these people as the enemies of the Lord. It didn't matter whether they were his enemies or not. They were the enemies of the Lord. Even that tells us something about David's perspective. His God-colored glasses, right? Even though the men are exhausted, they press the battle. It's not enough to just sort of get our people back, but he presses the battle over the course of about 24 hours. I find it so ironic that they cry out, "This is David's spoil." Just 24 hours ago, they've been calling for David's head, and now they're praising David. This is David's victory. He led us to this victory. The fickleness of the crowd, right? They retrace their steps. They're reunited with the 200 exhausted men that they had left at the brook Besor. Again, certain of David's men make it quite clear that those 200 shouldn't have any share in the plunder. But David pushes back. He reminds them of the nature of their relationship. He addresses them as brothers. Right? We're family here. We're comrades. And more importantly, he reminds them of the source of their victory. You should not do that. You should not be selfish with this plunder, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. And some of David's men might have been thinking, "What do you mean what the Lord gave us? We fought tooth and nail. We were exhausted. We earned this." David has to remind them, no, the Lord won this victory. All right, I find it interesting here in this text. It says that they put all the Amalekites to the sword except for 400 young men who escaped on camels. Do you remember how many David brought into battle? He had 600 initially, 200 stayed at the brook. He had 400 that he went into battle with. And they destroyed the Amalekites except for 400 who... And the point is, David and his men were vastly outnumbered here. And God gave them the victory in this battle. And even in the euphoria of, you know, they're doing their touchdown dance right here at the end of the battle, and they had won. And even in the midst of that, David's recognizing, no, this is the Lord. This is the Lord who gave us this battle. And he establishes a principle here that everyone is to share alike. He says the person who guards the baggage is just as important as the one who engages in the battle. And he establishes really a law here, a decree, which is kind of interesting. Like, David's not even king. But when you look at the chronology here, it seems that maybe at this very moment, Saul is dying on Mount Gilboa. And David issues his first proclamation as king, a principle that is established here for the people of Israel. David goes a step further to distribute the plunder among the people in the southern portion of Israel. Maybe it looks like he's just currying favor with them, right? Trying to make some friends. But I think David's just trying to reaffirm his loyalties. Being clear, he'd been living among the Philistines. But even when he was living among the Philistines, he was still fighting God's enemies covertly. He never changed his allegiances. And even by giving this plunder to the people in these southern towns, he communicated again his fidelity to Israel and her God. Well, the challenge for some is suffering, right? In crisis. What do we do in crisis? But I think probably the bigger challenge, the greater challenge, is prosperity. How do we handle it when things go well with us? Do we continue to maintain a Godward perspective? How are you doing with handling success? I believe that sometimes this mindset of David's men even creeps into the church. We come to think of our possessions as ours. We earned them. We sometimes fail to think that it's God who gave us a healthy mind and a healthy body. It's God who takes my work and makes something out of it, right? It's sometimes easy to forget that. Maybe this is the greatest demonstration of David's perspective here in the midst of his success. Here's my typo in the slides here. This is supposed to, oh, you fixed it. I didn't even have to say anything. Katie must have fixed it for me. Ungodliness. I shouldn't have even said it, see? Ungodliness is living one's everyday life with little or no thought of God or of God's will or of God's glory or of one's dependence on God. It's a great quote by Jerry Bridges. So godlessness is living as if God did not exist. And there's several passages that reflect on this. Jude 4, for certain people who have crept in unnoticed, who pervert the grace of our God into sensuality, who use God's grace as an excuse to just do whatever they want to do. Romans 1, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. So part of the nature of sinful humanity is that they have rejected God. They've tried to ignore God. They've tried to suppress any knowledge of God. That's a godless mindset, right? I just live without any thought to God. And unfortunately, it's a mindset that can creep into the life of even a professing Christian. Philosophy can creep into the church. May God help us to embrace the mindset of David. We too would put on our God-colored glasses in the midst of our struggles and our decisions and our successes, that we would come to see things from his perspective.